episode number 209, where we are going to be talking about children's data. Specifically, the session is called Designing a Child-Friendly Digital Environment. I'm not entirely sure we're going to be able to do that, but we are going to absolutely talk about children's data and kind of the complexities around processing that and kind of anything from our experiences of how best to handle it. I am joined, as ever, by the returning Phil Brining, as he's not been here for a couple of weeks. Good afternoon, yeah. Phil.
Good afternoon. So hardly as ever, if I've not been here for a few weeks, but yeah.
You've been around for the 4 years we've been doing these, though.
I've been around, yes. Anyway, hello, yes.
Good afternoon. And we are joined this week with one of our newer hosts, Miss Katerina Santos. Good afternoon, Katerina.
Hello.
How are you doing? How are you both doing? All right? I've already asked you that, haven't I? So yeah, sorry.
Good.
Good. On.
A little bit of housekeeping before we get started. We do record these sessions. There is a privacy notice on screen now. We rely on legitimate interest to record and put these out online afterwards for people who can't join live. You do have the right to object, so please do reach out to us if you'd like to exercise that right, and we will see what we can do. Please do get involved in the session, jump in the chat, unmute, dive in. We do really enjoy it when people get stuck in and contribute to these sessions. They are yours as much as they are ours. Before we get started, we will discuss the news, probably about 10 minutes because we're a little bit late starting. And yeah, so how's yours two's week's been?
Mine's been really interesting, broken up, to be honest, because I was in London. I know you were in London for 2 days. I was in London for 2 days as well. But bizarrely, I was at a drinks reception at Downing Street on Tuesday night, which was...
In Downing Street?
Yeah.
Oh, you didn't say you're in Downing Street.
No, that's where I was. Number 11, though, not number 10. Although, that was quite really interesting, actually, to get down there and get in amongst, you know, a few people.
What were you doing down there?
Brief chat with a chancellor, which was very, very pleasant. He was a very, very nice person. I got invited to a drinks reception through my younger brother, who's done a lot of work in the arts in Leeds, and Rachel Reeves is the MP for Leeds, which I didn't know. So I was wondering what the connection was. It turns out she's the MP, and they've done a lot of work together, my brother and the Chancellor, over the last 13 years or so. And he's leaving the West Yorkshire Playhouse, where he is now, Leeds Playhouse, and he's going up to Edinburgh. So just did this event, which is great.
Oh, that's good. The Londoners boy.
so that was it. But I had 2 days off, so I've come back in like on Thursday, like to a blizzard of emails and stuff like that. So it's never good having time off, is it, in the middle of the week?
No, definitely not. What about you, Kate? How's your week been?
It's been all right. I arrived from Portugal on Monday. Unfortunately, I don't know why, but I think my immune system is against English weather. So I got sick on Tuesday and Wednesday, and I was back yesterday, kind of recovering from, I don't know what I had. But it's been all right, putting my emails up to date, finishing some projects with some clients, delivering some end-over notes to our new consultant. And yeah, pretty much it. What about you? I think for the three of us, you had the most exciting week, didn't you?
Yes, I guess you could call it exciting. I had the pleasure of joining Jordan down at the IAPP Data Protection Intensive Conference in London. So I went down Tuesday afternoon and came back late last night. So similar to you guys, had a very bitty week in terms of doing actual work, although I guess you could class it as work. I was representing the brand, trying to sell the podcast to fellow data protection practitioners, trying to just say, you know, look, you can claim your CPE credits. People did ask me how you do that, and I said, I'm not sure. So I had to point them to the blog that Miles wrote for him a couple of weeks back. And I had some really good conversations actually with people that did seem interested in the podcast, and a few people they thought there was a catch with a podcast. They couldn't quite understand why we put on free sessions for data protection practitioners. I tried explaining that it's a lonely role, and we just try to do our best to support people in their day-to-day roles as DPOs and fellow practitioners. I think it was a good session. I did actually forward on the invites to a few people that we spoke to, just to give them a bit of a flavour of the sort of things that we do. So I don't know if anyone has joined from that because it was very last minute. But yeah, so that's what I've been up to this week.
Was it good? Did you get into any other sessions, or were you manning the stand?
No, I was, because it was only me and Jordan. I didn't want to leave him on his own, although I probably could have dived off once or twice to go listen to a couple of the sessions. I think one of them was actually around children's data. Yeah. So probably,
George Edwards were there.
Was he?
Yeah, John Edwards, yeah.
So it's probably a good job I didn't go in there.
Yeah.
To be honest, one bit of feedback I did get from somebody I spoke to was that these sort of sessions are really good. They are really useful when they do talk about the problems, but they don't really give solutions. Almost as if the people that are kind of, you know, on these sessions, on the panels, they don't really want to put the foot in it in case it kind of comes back on them, which, you know, I do get to an extent. But, you know, people want practical solutions, don't they? You know, when you're sat talking about.
Do you mean these sessions or sessions at the IAP?
No, at the IAP.
Oh, right, okay, yeah. I'm going to say we often put our foot in it.
Yeah. No, we do. And that was what I said. I said, well, we do similar. We talk about issues, but we actually do then, like you say,
volunteer
put our foot
some,
in it.
Yeah. Some
and
suggestions.
Heavily caveat it by saying, you know, this is our opinion and it's up to you whether you listen to it or not. But yeah, they did say that these would prefer the sessions to kind of go into a little bit kind of more
solution. Probably they don't want to compromise themselves with like a proper solution, because in the end of the day it depends, isn't it? So
well, that's right, yeah, you could get taken out of context quite easily. You know it's like when we're dealing with any inbound query, often we don't get full information, so you know, having to make assumptions, which is quite dangerous.
Yes, it can be.
Yeah, that's good. So you met any, like, anyone in consultancy data protection that, I don't know, that was interested in our, I don't know, in what we do? Anyone interesting? Any conversation that?
I did have one interesting conversation actually with an individual. I can't remember her name, so apologies if you're listening live. But we had a conversation about the podcast, and I mentioned that we're doing the one today on children's data, and she actually brought up a news story to do with. I think it's four children in, I don't know if they're American, or they're British children, and they were on TikTok and they saw a trend, and it ultimately resulted in death, unfortunately. And I believe the parents are in a bit of a case with TikTok at the moment, trying to retrieve the data. And I think TikTok have now actually announced that it may have been deleted. I don't know if either of you two have seen that, but it is quite prominent in terms of the sessions that we're talking about today, and the issues around kind of the law and kind of how it applies to people that are deceased, kind of the nuances around that. So I don't know if either of you two saw that at all, and we maybe might be worth just trying to explore it if you have.
I
was gonna say I kind of saw it a little bit, but I didn't really I can't remember when was it recently. I can't remember now.
I think it was a month or two ago.
I thought it was really recent. I mean, I think the main problem was the fact that they would try to retrieve the data, and that the data was no longer available because of the legal obligations. So they was following their retention schedule, apparently, and they deleted the data. And now they are trying to retrieve the deleted data. I mean, I think this is the big question is in terms of deceased people. Okay, to hear the UKGPR will not be applicable anymore. So we'll be kind of between having data retention policies and they are clear, and the fact that we are under investigation now. So can we go to the backup data, for example? Anything that could be important? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think the interesting point on my side of it is around that, yes, the GDPR doesn't apply to people that, you know, are dead, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you can then just start going and sharing, you know, deceased people's information.
But they, the fact that they are parents, I do think they can have a legal background to actually request that the child's data. I'm not sure about the child's age in here, but the parents are the legal representatives.
They were 14 year olds, for 13 or 14 year olds.
I mean, I am quite sure until the 12, they can represent the child in acting, actually, the data, their data and the personal data and the information that they have on their side. That's why the UKGPR probably is kind of great question, because UKGPR is no longer applicable here. So they will not have the right to apply a SAR on their regard. So.
I mean, if you kind of forget about the fact that we're talking about deceased people. I mean, the principle still stands, you know, should parents have the right to access, you know, the browsing habits, social media accounts of their children for under certain circumstances. I think that's, you know, one of the key topics to touch on today.
100%.
So I kind of read a little bit about that. You said it was interesting to chat through. Did you want to talk through anything further, Joe, about it?
I don't know. I mean, is there anything that we can kind of give an angle on? So, I mean, I did make some notes on it. I've just found them, so apologies for that. But there's Giles Derrington, who's a senior government relations manager at TikTok, said that they, you know, there's something that they simply don't have because of legal requirements around when they remove data. And he did go on to say that it's really complicated stuff because it relates to the legal requirements around when we remove data, and we have, under data protection laws, requirements to remove data quite quickly that impacts on what we can do. So they always want to do everything they can to give answers on these kind of issues, but there are some things which simply we don't have. So they're not really giving too much away, are they there? That's not, you know, I wonder what the parents are looking for. Are they looking for trends? Are they looking for what the child has accessed? Now, I've not actually had a look at any sort of policies around how long TikTok keeps hold of data. But if somebody's got an account and they've got, you can look at, back at your view history, can't you?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure you can look quite far back. And this is a very recent case that it happened, I think, this year. So it does seem to me quite, not say concerning, but questionable that the information may have been deleted, almost as if TikTok's got something to hide.
As soon as they saw about this, yes.
They're hiding behind the GDPR. Oh, no, we can't possibly do that because it's against the law. You know, we get that quite often, don't we? Oh, we can't possibly do that because of GDPR.
They say that we can't.
Exactly. Yeah. Can't cross the road there because of GDPR. I mean, there's all sorts of things you can't do because of GDPR, apparently.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the parents want to see their children's final online interactions, right? So apparently, what they are looking for is any correlation or link between what actually happens and if they actually link to the TikTok and the videos.
Yeah, but surely if it's some sort of challenge, this viral challenge that's going around, then surely there must be other instances of that challenge being on the platform. So, you know, That's a bigger principle, isn't it? You know, yes, we can't get to the records that your children saw because we've deleted those. But, you know, is this something that is on the platform that, you know, and how does it work? How does that algorithm work? We have a right to know how these algorithms work. And that's one of the interesting things, isn't it, about automated decision making.
I've just took the decision to just go on TikTok now and search it. So I've just gone on TikTok and searched blackout challenge, and it's just popped up to saying your safety matters. Some online challenges can be dangerous, disturbing, or even fabricated. Learn how to recognize harmful challenges so you can protect your health and well-being. And then it says view resources, give feedback, and then a phone number to Samaritans for me to call
if you are in danger. But did they let you see anything? No.
No, absolutely nothing. I don't think you'll be able to see that, but it's just a thing. I can't scroll. Even if I slide across to like top videos, users and so on, there's absolutely nothing for me.
I think in terms of social media, actually in the online platforms, etc., the big thing that we need to talk about is actually exactly what you said, Phil. I think the fact that how the algorithms actually work and how do they target people and how to profile people is actually really important, because mainly the TikTok, and nowadays is something that came to our mind and came to our news very, very common now. Everyone is talking about the Reddit, the TikTok, Facebook, anything around children. And I feel that in TikTok, I do remember when TikTok first started, or I started to use it, I saw these kind of challenges around children just going through like, are you able to do this? And if you do this, we'll have more interactions, more likes, more comments, and you just went viral. And that's exactly what is important. And then children is seeing this. And I don't know, this makes me feel really uncomfortable, because in the end of the day, until now, when I think we will go in depth very soon in Online Safety Act, etc., we don't have anything to protect them, and in terms of these actually contents that can be, even if it's not illegal, is harmful. So how can we actually protect them in this instance?
Yeah, I'm just interested in the chat. You know, we in typical style, we have come completely off piste, so we haven't covered what's been in the news or anything. We just dive straight into some stuff, which is how these sessions run for anybody that is new. They're loosely structured, and really, we kind of liken it to a bunch of privacy practitioners having a pint down the pub, which is what you're going to be doing on Monday night on St. Patrick's Day, I guess. rather than a kind of we don't like those formal presentation style podcasts. We prefer this kind of chatty style, but maybe some people don't. But in the chat, what we've got here is they're talking about SARS and the children's right of access. And again, I just wondered what we all felt about that. You know, so on the one hand, we recognise that children have got a right to privacy, but also on the other hand, we recognise that parents have got a right to know what's going on at school and in other environments. And not being, you know, being refused a SAR, how do we feel about that? Do you think that's the right approach to take, or the wrong approach, or, you know, I don't know what we all think about it.
I mean, I had I helped Susan a few months ago with the SAR that came through, and they had exactly the same question. It was about the age and what will be the criteria in terms of school and should be rejected or not, and what will be the ground for that. If I remember correctly, the UK states that a child that is age 12 or over, you can talk directly with the parents and they will be able to actually represent them in the SARS. So that means that for exclusion, something that is under 12, they will be considered mature and capable
generally,
to actually...
Generally, competence, but that's the guide, ICO's stance and guidance, isn't it?
Yes.
So,
To be honest, I'm not sure how I feel about this in terms of the age. How can it just be rejected because of the age? I think we should ask for more information in that, in terms of ground, and probably go to the child and to understand, well, if he's happy with it or not, if he's...
What if the child refuses? I mean, the context has to be surely materially important to making that decision. Now, what is it that you want and why do you want it? And if it's, well, I'm concerned about their well-being, surely that should prevail over, oh, but they're 13, they've got to make their own mind up.
And there is a situation where, for example, in like worst case scenarios where actually the child, or you have like separate parents, or you actually have parents that actually have a domestic violence or something, any problems safeguarding and risks to the child. How can you actually draw a line and understand the context on that? I think that's really important to understand, I think. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I've already said what I think. I'm just reading the chat again. You know, the 12, DFE have said 13, you know, 12, 13, 14. You know, if a parent's got or a guardian has got a responsibility, parental responsibility for well-being, you know, you can see in some cases, then I would say, well, yeah, you can see that there should be the right of access to certain information about them. On the other hand, like you just said about a case of domestic violence, it was absolutely not, because it could work. And we are sat in the middle as privacy practitioners trying to, you know, arbitrate on this kind of half known information.
Mm-hmm.
Always trying to err on the side of caution, so that, you know, once a cat, so I was saying to somebody yesterday or the day before, once a cat's out of the bag, it was yesterday, once a cat's out of the bag and that data is in the public domain, that's it. It's like those fantastic posters that the ICO has produced about the ripple effect. You know, you can't take it back. It's there. People know it, you know, and therefore you've got to try and guard against that in the very first place. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the root of escalation is that the data subject would complain eventually to the ICO. The ICO changed their policy now, but they expect it to resolve your matters with the data controller. But if you can't, you go to the ICO would look at it and say, I think you should have disclosed this. Mm-hmm. Well, that's better than, you know, in a rush disclosing something and then finding that there's been an almighty, you know, problem because of that.
I think I mean, we don't have much aside from what actually have provided by the law or any instructions by the ICO or any other authority in this regard. I think the important thing is to understand, well, the age is our criteria. And I think when we talk about 12, 13, 14, and I mean, we have a very interesting case that we came to the news as well, that the UK well, is talking about probably banning the social media from under 16 years old. When you're talking about age, is the only criteria that we might have to distinguish between children. So if they are mature or not will depend on the number, that is, they are actually age, which in one hand I understand, because, I mean, we are trying to make these a very general requirement.
You've got to have simple rules, haven't you?
Yes. But the other way, I think I think it's not enough. I think it's not sufficient. I mean, I have an opinion that we sometimes treat children, if they are not aware of the consequences, if they are not aware completely about the risks, etc. I know they are probably not as much as we are, because we actually practitioners and we are aware of this because we read and the newspapers and we are actually interested in these themes. But I feel that sometimes the guidance is always treating the children as they are completely immature and not aware of the consequences. And I think we shouldn't. I think the onus should be in parents and education, but we should be treat children as actual people that are actually aware of the things. I don't know.
I think you're referring to the Safer Phones Bill, are you? That MP Josh McAllister has tabled in the comments, when you say about banning children from using phones in schools, for instance, and access to social media under the age of 16. Is that what you're referring to, the Safer Phones Bill?
I was just mentioning in the news.
It came from Sir Chris Whitty, was asked to draw up advice for parents and kids on the harms done to young people.
Different again, and
saying that, and he would look at whether to raise the digital age of consent from 13 to 16, which would force social media firms to change their terms and conditions. I think it will come to the House of Commons imminently, I think, and ministers expected to get behind the rejig plans. I think that's what you're referring to, is it? And then that will be the direct consequence of that would mean that children won't be able to go onto social media platforms unless they're over 16, unless they got parental consent.
Exactly.
But the thing is with that for me is that I just don't see how you can kind of disregard children accessing online unless they're 16. I mean, you know, the world these days, everything's online. We have to do so much online.
And it ain't just phones either, is it? I mean,
no,
it's Fire Sticks, it's computers, it's tablets, it's gaming consoles.
And you decide to do that, right? You decide to ban people in the UK from not being able to access online services until they're over the age of 16. Do you know how far behind those people are going to be of other children in other jurisdictions because they've been able to access? You know, it's important, especially in how, you know, prevalent the online world is these days, that children are given access to that. Now, in my opinion, though, they need to do so safely. And for me, yes, it's easier to just ban children not being able to access till they're over 16. But for me, it's on the organisation. It's the organisation's responsibility to put measures in place to make sure that the environment that children are accessing is safe for them to do so. I mean, TikTok, for example, right? They've got this amazing algorithm that knows exactly what I like to be able to chuck up a video for me to, you know, to keep me on the app. So how on earth is that algorithm not good enough to scan and identify issues within the material that's online to know that it's a risk? I just I can't wrap my head around it. And I'm not necessarily looking for an answer here, but it's just frustrating to somewhat kind of blame it on the children, as if to say, not to hold the organisations responsible.
You're raising a fantastic point, Joe, which is that, you know, one half of it is kind of the stick and the other half of it is the carrot. And the carrot is, you know, the legislation in place, like the GDPR, the Data Protection Act, the Online Safety Act, and the Age Appropriate Design Code of Practice, which is statutory code of practice. They're there to try and make the environment safer, aren't they? To try and regulate the environment. And then the other side of it, you know, is the right. So you've got the access side, and then you've got the content side, haven't you? So people want to access this content, but you know, what are the providers doing? You know, it's not just about beating the children up, saying, "Oh, you can't use a phone." It's about getting the providers and the content developers, you know, to toe the line. And I was interested. The ICO's announced the success of their children's code strategy, haven't they, this week? The progress and I kind of thought, oh wow, this will be really interesting to you. It's actually quite underwhelming. I don't know what you thought. Did you see that? That they've No, announced.
I've not read it.
Well, what they're saying is basically they're saying that there's five platformers have improved or committed to improve their default privacy settings. Four platformers have improved their default geolocation settings. Two platforms have turned off or have committed to turn off personalized adverts under all 18s. And one platform has committed to reduce age assurance methods. Now, you know, what platforms? I suppose is the obvious question. Is it big platforms we've all heard of or is it tiny little platforms? So, it's been in place for a while, you know, the age appropriate design code of practice, but you know, that might be, you know, five platforms in total all committing to these kind of things. You know, we don't know. There's no devil in the devil's in the detail, isn't it? But I don't know whether that's impressive stats or not impressive stats.
I mean, the code is already being applicable since 2021, if I'm not mistaken. I think, in fairness, with the Online Safety Act, because I mean, the Children's Code is actually is not a law, is it? It's just instructions to actually how the UK GDPR will be applicable to protect the children. And because I think that the UK GDPR was not written thinking about them, and now they are trying to, considering the nowadays, just they are trying to make it more applicable to children. I think the Online Safety Act, because it's a law, is more content moderation is applicable to children as well. But I don't think these numbers are quite impressive, to be honest. I think obviously they are important, but we don't have much information. And they add that they have three live investigations open around TikTok, Reddit, and Imgur? Yeah, around their age again and the age assurance measures. And I think that's a very interesting topic again, because it was, I'm not sure if it was last session or two sessions ago, that we talked about, it was a Valentine session, that we talked about how can you actually do age verification mechanisms and how can you implement? Because I think, again, the age, as we saw previously, age is actually our criteria to define anything. So one of the things that both code and the Online Safety Act requires from the organizations actually have the age mechanisms to verify their age, etc. And I saw in the majority of the platforms, and we saw this as well for the dating apps with me and Joe, that the majority of them ask for their declaration. So asking them, all right, so how old are you? Give me your date of birth. And that's it. And that's our age verification mechanism.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we are talking about harmful content, maybe illegal bullying kind of stuff, cyberbullying, etc. And we are relying on this type of mechanisms to, well, to provide access to the things.
It's even worse than that, though. It's even worse than just online content. Now, we're all aware of the unfortunate, well, the horrific murders in Southport. Last summer or the summer before.
Yeah, I think
it turns out the individual responsible purchased the knife from Amazon when he was 17 years old.
Yeah.
You know, which is just mental, right? You know, how have Amazon not put adequate measures in place to verify the age of somebody to purchase? How are you even able to purchase a knife off Amazon of that type? I know you can get, you know, kitchen knives and stuff. So it's, I don't know about guns. Not
no, angry. I'm sorry, concerned.
maybe in Portugal, Kate. But
sorry.
The thing is, though, the point I'm trying to make is that there are organisations who do have adequate measures in place. I remember when I was 17 and I wanted to bet right, so I downloaded Paddy Power.
Yeah.
And their betting companies are really quite thorough with the age verification process. Well, they were when I was 17 for whatever reason. I don't think I even submit anything, but they knew that I was under the age of 18. And they banned me, and I can't go on there now. But any other sort of verification sites on like betting sites, I think, I don't know if they share information between each other's betting companies, but it's a little bit easier for me to do so now to kind of sign up to betting companies. But when I was 17, it's almost as if it's like, how the hell do you know that I'm not over the age of 18?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think those, in terms of, I'm not sure about if there was actually hemmed buying, or I think you could use like these parents' account, because they're always that, because we never know who is the other side, do we? So it's always the risk. Something that I find quite interesting, and I was trying to find in the ICO kind of guidance, etc., that is, okay, so if you want me to have age age verification mechanisms. Let's see if the ICO, or in terms of instructions or guidance, if there is any list, if there is any examples, if there is any criteria. And I saw again the words reasonable, and probably will be depending on the size and the types of processing of the company, needs to be like a risk assessment kind of thing. But again, there is no kind of examples. And I know that the COPA, the California Children's Code, they have quite a very extensive list of examples. The same thing for the parent mechanisms control. But we don't, in terms of instructions, obviously you can use it as an example for us, but we don't. And I think, again, I mean, is it up to the organizations to actually verify this? What will be the criteria? How do we do this? Who is responsible for this?
Is it just a box ticking exercise? Sounds like. I mean, age verification sounds like.
Oh, I lost you.
Yeah, he's frozen on mine as well.
Yeah, we lost Phil. Well.
And sorry, I wasn't listening to your point. I was just responding in the chat.
But I do remember when you're talking about the news in terms of the age, etc., you raised a really good point that was around the education, and this shouldn't be on. We lost you, Phil. Hello again.
Hello again. I'm back.
You froze.
You froze. You're back.
Yes, I heard. Now, I was just saying that surely age verification is a process that one would be required to do a DPIA on.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously it's got, if you get it wrong, and then potentially it's got negative consequences. So it's high risk processing, isn't it? Or is it? You know, I would say it probably is. But
do you know, we know though, Phil, from doing audits recently, how inadequate organisations carry, you know, data protection impact assessments out. Yeah. They're often incredibly poorly constructed, and just no kind of real critical analysis. And you know, I mentioned it last week, because I think we got in a very similar kind of conversation around DPAs and kind of how important they are. And you know, I've been doing an audit for a laboratory testing company, one of the biggest in Europe, and their DPAs were so superficial, I couldn't believe it. You know, the risks that they identified for pay, they outsourced payroll, and the consequence was potential loss of data and consequence of monetary penalty notice. But what about the risk of staff not being paid and not being able to pay bills? And, you know, they're the real risks that we want to see in DPAs. Not that you might get fined. But anyway, let me not get on soapbox. But that's what I was trying to say to you, Phil, is that, you know, you are right that you would think that these processes would be ironed out by the DPO. And maybe they are ironed out by the DPO, but then the businesses are just not listening to them. Because that's another potential thing here, isn't it? Yeah. That the DPO is saying, look, you can't do this. But the bosses of that organisation could go, I'm not listening to you. I go do what I want.
Because one of the arguments will be always the costs. I mean, exactly, these things cost money, don't they? So
everything's around money, isn't it?
I told you. No, but I think you raise a good point in terms of when you're talking about the news, that is the responsibility or the owners should be more in education and the organization side of it rather than actually the child. And I think you are actually really, really right on that. I completely agree with you. I think we should go for the parents. But again, as I was saying in the beginning, I think sometimes the guidance and the things that I read just mistreat children. Obviously, I know that it's a very complex and complicated matter, but normally we treat children as because they are immature and they don't know aware. But I speak for my parents. I can assure you that my parents have no awareness completely about what they are doing, what the risks are, what is going on in this online world, etc., etc. So they can actually be a risk. If I was a child, they can actually be the one saying, no, you are not aware, like you can't assess to this because of the risks of this or that. And they are not even understanding what they are saying, you know. So I think it should be a balance. I think surely this should go for the education purpose, like schools.
I agree. I was going to say, I think the argument
that majority schools should be the ones.
I think the argument that children don't understand the consequences is just, it's fair, but teach them the consequences then. Like, why is online kind of, I don't know, online activities and online safety not taught in the curriculum? Like, why is that not covered in schools? Teach children. you know, the dangers of online, because you can't avoid it. Everything's online, like, especially now, like, it's going to be worse in 5-10 years. So, you know, the Department of Education needs to have a look, really, and think, right, you know, what can we do to assist the children in accessing online materials safely?
I think Michael has his hand.
I just wanted to say, you're absolutely right, Joe. I think I can't say what the advert was, but New Zealand's been doing some material for parents and kids, and just trying to make people aware about the consequences of what they see and understand from online. But it should be something that's broached. I think some people just try to avoid it because they feel like they won't represent it or they don't understand it themselves. But I think, you know, maybe they should be, you know, they're getting a professional to give them some advice and tips. Mm-hmm. It's like you said, everyone's saying in the chat, it's a very complex matter, especially mm-hmm. with the child's maturity. I mean, if we do mental capacity reviews of people who we're not sure if have the capacity to make a decision, it's got to be something similar, and it's going to kind of got to be quite clear that the person has exhibited the potential to make a decision, not decision on their behalf. Because you do have people who are more mature or less understanding and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But it's not my area, so I'll try not to fall into that trap. But I did have a case once, and I put a chat in the chat once, where a person who was a domestic abuser did try to get his child's information. And he requested a copy and a deletion of a lot of the data. He's lashing out basically with this process. And actually, the social worker said that actually the children could make a decision, and they were under 13 years old, and they said no, basically, to it. And they used that. But I don't, maybe it has to be carefully looked at in every situation. In case there's special reasons why the person shouldn't get it as well,
mm-hmm.
that the children may not understand. Yeah.
Thanks for that, Michael. I mean, to be fair, just to say, a few people have just let me know that, you know, these things are taught in schools. I don't thank you.
Sounds
for letting
patchy
me know.
Though. Sounds patchy.
Yeah, I was gonna say I've not been at school for 10 years. I was gonna make the point.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's like if it's just, you know, the odd school that's kind of taking the kind of initiative and saying, look, we need to do something about this. And it's the same for, you know, the other side of things in mm-hmm. the world of, you know, there's a lot of things I think that should be taught in curriculums that aren't, but that's just a whole other matter.
I think in terms of the parental, just to stay on just the parent, if you don't mind, I just have like a quick question, and I really want to hear both of your thoughts. That is, I think we need to balance between, because the Online Safety Act actually requires more involvement of the parents and the parent controls, and try to instigate more kind of a design by default in terms of everything is off unless you actually want to put it on, and require parental controls in terms of the access to these social media and those these social platforms. But I think we need to have a balance between actually the parent controls and actually their access to involvement in children's, and the freedom of the child to be actually a person, in the right for them to actually privacy, and today a data to be private. And I think it's kind of a balance that we need to do.
It's a really tricky balance.
It is. Because where is the line? I think, the line?
I started reading this book about it's about Gen Z and, you know, the problems with issues.
Learning
with
some stuff.
Gen Z. And, you know, this book is by a famous psychologist called, Haider, H-A-I-D-E-R, I can't remember his first name. Anyway, he was saying that, you know, the issues are because that generation have been severely protected. You know, they're not being playing on the street, they're not being doing the things that my generation used to do. And, you know, they haven't experienced enough of life and what it throws and challenges at them. Therefore, you know, they've got different traits, which isn't a bad thing. But if you lock it down even further, where I'm getting to with this, if you say, oh, no, you've got to lock it down even further.
Yeah.
You know, we don't necessarily know what issues that's going to cause, you know, whereas if you open it up, maybe because people learn, especially if it's supported in the education environment, maybe people learn better. I don't know. You know, again, it's not like Mike, it's not my area of expertise.
It's an interesting point. And, you know, Rachel's left a comment saying that, you know, she doesn't feel that people who are 13 and 14 understand the risks in the same way that an adult can.
Well, if you understand the risks, are they reaching a rational, informed decision. So I understand the risks and I understand the consequences, but I'm not that bothered about the consequences as much as I, you know, so... I think
that's another, I agree with you. I think that's another problem.
Rachel, you do have your hand up if you want to jump in, not to put you on the spot.
Yeah, Jonathan Haidt, that's the one, yes. That's the book I've been reading.
Well, we've not heard from Rachel, so she may not want to join us, and that's completely fine. But the point is that I was going to make is, but, you know, children may not understand the risk, but when I was, you know, 7, 8, 9, I was out in the streets and my mum told me not to go and speak to strangers, right? And I understood the risks of doing so. So, you know, I don't know, that maybe that's not quite a fair kind of comparison, but I think...
What is your point?
I've done it. Sorry.
Well done.
I'm there.
Hello.
Honestly, technology. What I was going to say was exactly that. I think when you're approached in the street by somebody that is a stranger that looks very different, I think that's really clear. When you're online and you're chatting with somebody that you think is another 13-year-old girl from another school, I think it's that's really difficult for them to potentially get the risk of that not being a girl from a similar, you know, it's, and you don't want to overload your kids with, and what I mean is this could happen. You know, I think it's that balance with parents in terms of not explaining, you know, not having to go into huge detail about this is what we mean. And I think that's a difficulty for parents. We know all the horrific things that go on. We see it in the news. Kids, I totally agree with you, Phil, what you said. I think it's about whether that risk is actually something that I'm that bothered about at 13. It's, you know, I know my parents keep saying, or it could be somebody who's not who you think it is, but I'm not bothered. I just want to chat with my friends, and that's what I think I'm doing. I think it's that kind of thing, really. But really good conversation to have. Thanks for having this conversation.
I don't know whose idea it was. Miles's, I think.
Though I really agree with you all. I think nowadays the balance should be in terms of parental controls and the fact that we need to actually involve the children, and because is one nowadays online world is a thing, so we need to just accept the reality and making sure that we actually protect rather than segregate or just exclude children from all of this. There are so many, I think with the COVID, I think was the main big point that where we kind of just start educating people and children using the laptops, we use more social media and platforms with it. I mean, I think was the starting point when we realized that we didn't have enough safeguards and enough legislation in the background to actually protect our data and protect ourselves as an adults or children. Obviously children, because more than the adults, because they are seen as a vulnerable group of people that in principle they don't understand the risks and that way. But again, we have our child-friendly privacy notice. If they want to read more about it, there is our requirements. And alongside with the parents, probably discussing what could be or not the risks that could be involved, the organizations actually have the accountability as well to provide all the information if they have any questions, to actually try to be more involved. And then schools, again, I think this could work.
I don't want to kind of change the topic. So if you want to...
Go for it.
Ignore me and get back on to topic. I'm just kind of wondering about, you know, we're all community privacy practitioners and we're, you know, familiar with the requirements of particularly the GDPR and the PECA and the Children's Code maybe. And we understand how that works. We know that the ICO is the supervisory authority for those things. And we're aware of what you just mentioned, privacy notices, you know, tracking, cookies, information society services, etc. The Online Safety Act is regulated by Ofcom, isn't it? And I'm just wondering how we expect that to sit in our world. You know, are we going to be responsible for ensuring compliance with the Online Safety Act because it's got online in it? Or is that going to fall on IT, or is it going to fall somewhere else? Mm-hmm. So, again, I don't know what people's thoughts are about whether it's a relevant discussion or not. But ultimately, you know, we're all here to get a job done, which is about, you know, safety processing data, upholding people's rights and things like that.
Yeah.
Is this a new thing we've now got to get a grip of? Is this a new thing we've got to roll out in our organisations? Is this a new thing we've got to go and audit as privacy practitioners? Or is it going to sit somewhere else?
I think probably a joint effort off the top of my head. Yeah, I mean, I've not really thought about it until you've kind of made the point, but it's a very good one. And I think probably joint effort of those responsible for your website and also you as a DPO or a data protection practitioner to advise what's kind of best. Because it's an interesting point you've kind of raised, Phil, and it was, you know, not to kind of flip it on its head again, but I was kind of thinking around, what about cookies? What about the use of cookies on websites? Because requires consent, doesn't it? But how does a website know that you're over the age of 13 to get consent from you? Now, I know that organizations should have websites aimed directly at kids, so you'd probably think they wouldn't have cookies on there. That doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, organizations do have those websites for you to go and access. So when children are visiting Access and they're seeing these cookie kind of banners coming up, they have no idea what they're accepting or what they're rejecting. I wouldn't have thought. And the consequence of that could be quite alarming. You know, we know how kind of challenging cookies can be and kind of behavior, you know, advertising can be a little bit naughty. You know, the things that you kind of see and then that are presented to you. I think that's really quite dangerous.
I think that's exactly what should be included in the risk assessment when you are thinking about what children could assess or not the website and what would be the risks of their dangerous or of the need for parents or not. I think that should be considered as well. Yeah.
Mm.
I don't know. Yeah.
All very interesting stuff. So, yeah, I mean, the children's code, you know, again, it has got these 15 principles in. Is it 15? It is, isn't it? 15 principles. Yeah. And, you know, it's called practice code. You know, it's statutory code of practice, which means it can be taken into account, but it's not actually the law. As such, is it? So, there's quite a mixed landscape that, again, we have to try and get our heads around. And I did read through the Online Safety Act, and it was 303 pages. And you know, it's... it's typically, you know, written typically, so it's, to me, you know, it seems difficult for people to understand and to work with, because that's the way that a lot of the British legislation is written. I love the GDPR for its simplicity, you know, in terms of the structure of it and the way it's worded and the way it references, you know, itself. You look at we all do, don't we? Look at the Data Protection Act, and you're chasing your tail before you know it. Yeah, anyway, I thought I was interested in, again, not wanting to move off topic, but I was interested in the ICO's speech, what John Edwards said at the IAP conference. He said that he was talking about focusing on cookies, Joe, on the big platforms. And he said, you may be sitting there thinking, so what? You know, the ICO are investigating three of the biggest social media and video sharing platforms. Smaller companies will still be able to operate with impunity, which suggests that he knows more than we may be giving credit for. He then goes on to say, but this would be a mistake. I want to make it very clear. By focusing our efforts on some of the largest, most well-known platforms, we're not giving smaller companies a free pass to adopt or continue unlawful practices. Again, is that insight? He knows where we are. Mm. He's taking a risk-based approach, as he meant to. He's top-slicing the big platforms with the highest risk. He said, instead, last week's announcement should serve as a warning shot. All organizations using children's data or who offer products or services aimed at young people need to comply with the law and conform with our children's code. Again, I think that's great because what he's saying, whether he actually backs it up with actions, what he's saying is, you know, you're not hiding under the radar. You know, small businesses that think we're not interested in you. We are. We just haven't got around to you yet.
Yeah. And I think it's probably the right approach, isn't it? You know, they can't attack everybody. So, as you say, from the top down is probably the best way to do it. The most visited websites makes most sense, doesn't it? Because that's where the most risk is, because it's the higher number of data subjects. Yeah. Unless, I guess, you maybe not only do the most visited, but most visited by vulnerable groups, although that's probably a little bit harder to kind of determine through analytics.
But I think it made sense to just go to the big ones and then the small ones could do use this as a warning. I think it was just, aside from that, he said, we want organizations to see our investigations and take it as a sign to get your own house in order. You shouldn't wait for the regulator knocking on your door before checking your processes.
I think everyone should, there should be a requirement to do like an annual audit. You know, maybe it's for certain processing activities, maybe it's for certain size of processing activities, maybe for certain sectors, but there should be a requirement to have an external authentication, verification, audit of of what's going on. You know, I think it's a real shortcoming in the GDPR not to have that. And it potentially was then, got 10 out, I don't know. But you know, you get it in other walks of life, don't you? You have to have financial audits, you have to have all sorts of other audits. By law, you have to. Why not? This is vitally important. You know, there's a lot of legislation. We've got all these different bits of legislation, Online Safety Act, GDPR. Yeah. It's important stuff. So, you know, why are ROPAs not in the public domain? Why are ROPAs, you know, not available to be inspected by data subjects? Why are there no requirements? I know I go on about the Jamaican law because I do a bit of work with it, but there's a requirement to submit what they call a data protection impact assessment, which is an annual return. It has to be submitted by the 31st of March every year, where a data controller assesses the impact of the entirety of their data processing. It's not been implemented yet because they're still trying to struggle with what that actually looks like. But they don't have like a DPI as we know it, a risk assessment process as a requirement. But they do have a public registration document, which is very, very detailed. And those sort of things, I think, keep data controllers and potential processors on the straight and narrow. And if you know it's that information in the public domain, open to scrutiny, then, you know, I think that's good accountability. I was interested that an Austrian company got fined €5,000 for allowing their MD to bid the DPO a couple of weeks ago.
Really? I didn't see that.
Conflict of interest, yeah.
Mm.
So it was, again, a relatively small business, laboratory company, 200 employees, did a lot of COVID-19 testing, but that was interesting, again, on accountability. And I know, I'm going off topic, but please, you know, correct me and bring it back up. Another thing that was interesting in the news this week was this. It was bizarre when I first read it. A freedom of information request made to the government asking how many times ChatGPT was used. And anyway, it transpires that that one of the MPs is using ChatGPT a lot and asking it to give advice about what podcasts this MP should attend and things like that. I thought Freedom of Information Act request, that's a bit strange, but I mean, when I double checked the Freedom of Information Act, I think, well, surely this isn't in scope. It absolutely is in scope. So, you know, so interesting stuff. People dream up some amazing questions, don't they?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, while we're doing the podcast in reverse, did you see the news story about CCTV and female toilets in Derbyshire?
There was
calls for Derbyshire Council to carry out a review of a CCTV camera in a female public toilet facility after the BBC found that inside of a cubicle is partially visible. Concerns were raised by local residents on social media that the public toilets in Ashbourne, after a woman complained the cameras made them feel violated. While no law prohibits the use of CCTV in public toilets, guidance from the ICO says that, you know, it must be in line with the Data Protection Act. That's a little bit woolly, isn't it, from the news story I read, but essentially saying that, you know, the process has to be, you know, as we know, fair, lawful, transparent, proportionate and necessary. I'm not really sure what the purpose of the processing is to have CCTV in
inside toilets.
I imagine maybe safety.
I read something around safety around women's.
But surely you can have it on. Surely you could have it on the outside and still probably meet that processing.
Yes.
You know, because if something was to happen within a window of time from a report from an individual, then you go check the CCTV and whoever accessed the toilets within that window possibly give you the answer.
Yeah, or a dummy camera might act as a sufficient deterrent. You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Kane said it was vandalism.
Prevention of crime. Prevention camera. I tell you, also, when I was in London this week, I went to the Globe Theatre. Walked along the South Bank, went to the Globe Theatre to just have a look around. And there was I took a picture of it. I was so astounded. There was a thing mounted on the wall that was taking your temperature. You had to look at this screen, and there was a picture of a shot, and it actually seemed to be linked to an access control system. So I'm really interested to dig around and find out what that is, because I think it's a facial recognition access control system that also takes your body temperature. So that I need to have a look at. But that was a real surprise to see that mounted on the wall at the Globe Theatre. Inside, you know.
Why would it be there for?
Oh, because some bright sparks thought, oh, this is a great way to do access control.
Yeah, exactly. No, I do remember those in the COVID times where you just threw around the roads or go into, I don't know, any space and just saw your temperature, body temperature, all over the place, but I thought you were already done.
Yeah,
I might be leaping to conclusions incorrectly assessing it as an access control system. But that's what it looked like to me. There was a screen next to it. Just looking at the picture now, The screen next to it said staff, visitor, or contractor. It sounds more than just taking a temperature.
They had them at Amazon when I was. I worked at Amazon when I was during lockdown, and we had to walk through these things that took our temperatures to make sure that we were boiling up to work.
Now Trudy's asking how to access the recordings. Now I don't know how we access them on Teams. I've been struggling this morning to access a recording I made this morning of myself, just because a bit note taking. Because I seem to have changed the interface. But all these Data Protection Easy Made Easy podcasts are put out on Spotify and another platform.
We lost him again. Oh.
Hello.
Hello. You did freeze, but I heard platform and then hello. But you're back.
Yeah,
now.
Just talking about how to access the recordings on Spotify is where they also end up, don't they? So if you can't get them through it from Teams, then at some point they end up on Spotify, usually a couple of days later.
Yes, yeah. I think if you're referring to when the video kind of appears in the chat feed, that's just for internal use. So Miles will process it. I think it'll be Eve, actually, because Miles on holiday, and they'll be available, as Phil says, on Spotify and our website pretty shortly after, if not today, early next week.
We're at 29 minutes past. So we definitely did this in reverse. We normally, for anybody that's new, we normally start off by having a quick recap of the news, and then we can talk about, if it's a GDPR radio, we just talk about, you know, stuff, wherever the conversation goes. If it's a topic like today, we're talking about, you know, the children-friendly environments, then, you know, we're doing the news and then we talk about the topic. But today we've done it all in reverse. But that's good. Keeps on our toes.
Absolutely.
Makes a difference.
So what have you got next week? So that's pretty much, this is probably the last minute of wrap-up into what have you got on next week? Anything exciting?
I don't know. I've been out of the office all week, so I've not really planned that far ahead. I've got a meeting, I think, with... I mean, me, Katerina, are sitting down with Robin to try and talk about some potential sales ideas. And then we're also meeting with you, I believe, on the Tuesday as well, around some of our IGF work. I think.
Yeah, we'll have a catch up on that. Yeah.
It'll be very internal meeting day.
Yeah, I'll be doing that on Tuesday. And then I don't really know, probably catching up with work that I've not been able to do this week. Yeah. What about you two?
Well, I've got a lot of write-up. I seem to be out for the last couple of weeks, so I've got a lot of write-up, including the IT section of your audit we did the other week. And what I'm going to try and get out of that is also IT audit checklist and some kind of idea about, you know, how we do go about in auditing IT in the context of GDPR and the kind of things that we're looking for. Looking at and trying to solicit information about. So I'm going to try and do that as well. I kind of drive a checklist, but my priority is to try and get your stuff written up and some other bits and pieces I've been working on as well.
Yeah, that'd be good.
And we will talk about the Doer Bill soon, because there's been some other stuff about it today, hasn't it? A lot of amendments got chucked out this week, and I'm absolutely convinced this one is going to go through.
Yes.
So, we need to be on the money with it. There's a lot of changes, you know, like the ICU getting repurposed and things like that. So,
yeah, well, next week's GDPR radio, isn't it? So then we've it's an hour, as you say, full of talking about stuff. So we will make sure we cover the Doer Bill. Kate, what have you got on next week? As Phil's asked you, I'd zoned out.
No, but it's my birthday, actually, so I'll not be the next.
Is it?
Yeah, next Friday. So I won't 30. Be.
No,
I'm in my latest 20s, not my 30s. Thank you very much. So I'll not be able to join you. I have a few meetings during my week. I have a few reports to actually draft until I go, because I took the day off on Friday. So
and you do right.
Yeah.
You do right.
Enjoy your birthday. We will call up our reserve host, Kane, to join us.
Oh, thank you.
To join me and Phil. And we will leave it there. Thank you very much, Kate, Phil, for joining me, as always, and everybody in the chat that has contributed and unmuted and participated. We really do appreciate it. And yeah, as I said, we'll be back next week for a GDPR radio session. So until then, goodbye for now.
Ta-da.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.